Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden, and I'm here with my co-host Jeff Patino, and we are here to talk to a special guest today, John Anthony West. But first, let us tell you a little bit about our show here. We're primarily focused on ancient cultures and the vast cycle of time that ancients believed in called the Great Year. We were told in school that the Great Year is nothing more than a fairy tale, and yet if we look at the ancient texts and myth and folklore from all around the world, we find that at least 50 ancient cultures, probably more, believed in this cycle of time with a golden age at one end and a dark age at the other. And it's this cycle that so many cultures talked about that we think is the primary paradigm of history nowadays, and one that has been forgotten as we now believe almost exclusively in this evolutionary or Darwinian paradigm. And yet, all over the world, we find evidence of very high cultures in the very, very ancient past. So, Jeff, maybe you can talk a little bit about John, so our guests know who we're talking with today.
Yeah, I'd love to. Today, our guest is John Anthony West. He's a world-renowned author and Egyptologist. He's written several books, and he's considered one of the leading authorities in the symbolist school of Egyptology, which has shown that ancient Egyptian architecture and art discloses a richer and more universal wisdom than has really previously been thought in by conventional archaeologists and historians.
And we had interviewed John in our film called The Great Year. The Great Year, that's Plato's name for this vast cycle of time, and he got rave reviews in that, so we're very pleased to have him on the show here today. I should probably back up and tell you that Jeff and I work with the Binary Research Institute here in Newport Beach, California. We are an archaeoastronomy think tank, and we have spent the last several years researching the idea that our solar system may be in a binary motion with another star. In other words, the sun has a companion star, and it is our motion around this star that indirectly is the cause of the rise and fall of civilization. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that a little later.
Yeah, we'll definitely be talking a lot more about that. And just for our listeners, a reminder that if you do want more information on the Binary Research Institute, you can always visit us at our website at binaryresearchinstitute.org. Or if you'd like more information on the topics we're talking about in the show, you can visit us at the website for Walter's book, LostStarBook.com.
And that book is called Lost Star, Myth and Time, and in that text, we outline probably a dozen different ancient cultures, their beliefs, their myth, folklore, and really what they were thinking when they formed their own histories, and how that those histories influence us today, and also the whole concept of the binary star.
Yeah, and those histories do influence us. In fact, I think one of the things that we'll be talking about with John when he comes on the show after the break is just the difference in looking at ancient cultures and mythology and how they seem to call back to an even earlier time, perhaps before what we would even consider recorded history, as far as civilizations in that time, and we'll look at why it's important to rewrite history and why is it necessary to look back to see if civilization is older than we think it is, and what evidence there is for that.
Well, that's certainly what ancient cultures tell us. And so this idea of a great year, that history moves in cycles with high ages of enlightenment and low ages of darkness, was really the predominant thought prior to the biblical theory of history that, of course, was brought about by the church, 1,500, 1,800 years ago. And then that was a very strong paradigm, at least in the West here, until probably the early 19th century when Spencer and Darwin came along. And since that time, we've had this strictly linear Darwinian paradigm, meaning anything that came before us must be more primitive. And by having that point of view, we've sort of lost some idea of the greatness of these ancient cultures. And so it's our thinking that we'd like to, try to re-understand or remember what the ancients were telling us, and so that we can have a richer, fuller heritage in our histories.
And we'll get into those topics and more right after the break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence with Walter Cruttenden and Jeff Pitino.
Expanding your mind. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden. I'm here with my co-host, Jeff Pitino. And we have a special guest star with us today, rebel Egyptologist, John Anthony West. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Walter.
Well, good to have you on the show.
Well, it's good to be on.
John, I've not yet had the opportunity to go on one of your famous trips to Egypt. I'm wondering if you've been there recently, if you have any upcoming trips anytime soon.
Yes, I've just come back, actually, from a February trip, which was, in fact, a particularly interesting one, because there were a number of very knowledgeable people from diverse fields on this trip. So actually, all kinds of small things and large were discovered within the group, and there was a lot of in-group debate over various issues. So it was a particularly good one. I have more coming up, but probably not till the autumn, though there may be a no-frills summer special if I get people interested in it, mainly designed for students and teachers and people who can only get away in the summer. Of course, it's hot as hell there in the summer, but it is doable. You just have to take it a bit easier and so on. So I am thinking about that, and anybody who wants further information on it, it's not up on my website yet, but anybody interested listening to the program can go get in touch with me via email, which is my initials, J-A-W, Sphinx, @AOL.com, and I can furnish details.
Great. Well, I've heard nothing but good things about those trips, so I hope to get on one myself. And how many times have you been to Egypt?
I don't know, but it must be close to 100 by now. I've been doing the trip since, now's the 20th year. And, you have to come along one day, actually, Walter, because really, the experience of Egypt, seen through symbolist eyes, is something very, very special. I mean, it's rare that somebody comes back from the trip and doesn't say it's the sort of the travel experience of a lifetime. And until you see it, no matter how much you read, no matter how many videos you see or photographs you look at, it's still, to a certain extent, on the page. Sort of like sex. You can read about it from now till doomsday until you've actually experienced it. You don't know what all the fuss is about.
Yeah. Well, what got you interested in Egypt in the first place? Is this something that goes back to your childhood, or what really sparked it?
No, not to my childhood. That's a long story, but I'll cut it very short. At a very early age, I realized what a lot of people now know at an early age, that we live in a lunatic asylum. And at the age of 19, I wanted to be the little boy who says the emperor has no clothes. and wanted to do this via, not via scholarship at all, but through creative writing and basically through ferocious satires, and was doing happily, going along happily doing that, getting a lot of things published and produced, making no money, but nevertheless getting them out there. And at a certain point, back in the 60s, when I was living in Spain, I became I became articulately aware of something I had been aware of before, that it wasn't always a lunatic asylum. And one thing led to another. First I was led to the Gurdjieff work and went to England to study that. And there got interested, there got introduced to the work of that remarkable French genius with the unpronounceable name, R.A. Schroller de Lubitsch. And all of a sudden, there were nonfiction books being generated, and so I started putting my energy into that, recognizing actually that Schroller had done something really important, which was to document and demonstrate in incontrovertible fashion, as far as I'm concerned, that the ancient legends and myths that talked about higher levels of civilization were in fact true, and that Egypt in particular, but by extension virtually all of the older civilizations of which there's anything left, we're at a much higher level of not just spiritual accomplishment, which is sort of obvious. You look at what they did and you understand, if you're not emotionally defective or spiritually dyslexic, that something very special and very unlike Walmart was going on back then. And so one thing led to another, and most of the last 35 years have been devoted mostly to Egypt, but to disciplines, tangential disciplines as well, and that's what got me into Egypt.
And you know, a good part of that, John, I know you've sort of been rewriting the history, so to speak, of what we hear about Egypt. And, you know, tell us a little about, a bit about that. I know you've taken a lot of flack for your views on ancient Egypt versus, you know, some of your typical Egyptologists out there today. Why bother? Why go through this?
And why is it important to rewrite history?
Well, yeah, this is a very good question. You might say that if we had a valid civilization of our own, a study of the past would be, to a certain extent, academic. Who'd care? But we stand at the moment, I think, at a crossroads with a kind of a spectrum of catastrophes facing us, and whether or not we get through them remains to be seen. But to my mind, one of the, even though it doesn't look as important as, let's say, saving the environment or, you know, not tossing any more atom bombs around or that sort of thing, that a change of mind, a change of ideas, is crucial to being able to find our way out of this morass. And it's by looking at the very real wisdom of the past as it gets developed and amplified that possibility becomes a possibility. Otherwise, it's just on the page as well. And so, I mean, the ground has been broken by a number of people over the last 100 years, really. I mean, despite what I call the Church of Progress being in control of our entire educational system and much else besides, our economic system also, there have been heretics. I'm not the first one by any means, and I can name some names, the Santayana von Dekkend in Hamlet's Mill, and the Tao of Physics by Fritjof Capra, and Gurdjieff himself, of course, but in a very oblique way. So there have been lots of people who have been contributing to this, let's say, reconsideration of ancient civilization, and probably none, in my view anyway, more important than Schroller de Lubitsch. And it was in doing my first book on Egypt, on Schroller, Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, that I ran across this single sentence by Schroller. Of course, the Great Sphinx has been weathered by water and not by wind and sand. And the penny dropped in the slot, and I realized that that was something that was amenable to scientific demonstration, whereas the rest of Schroller, I mean, even his magisterial reinterpretation of all of ancient Egypt, based as it was upon measurement and very careful scholarship, was still not, in the usual sense, science. And in fact, that statement of his, that observation of his, that the Sphinx had been weathered by water and not by wind and sand, was itself at the end of a very long chapter in one of his auxiliary books, where he was talking about the ancient Egyptians' own belief that their civilization stretched many, many thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, actually, back into the past. But even that argument, though it was cogent and compelling in its own way, was still a textual argument based upon certain texts of the Egyptians and statements made by the writers of classical antiquity of Greece and Rome. But the water weathering, that was geology, and in principle, it should be possible to prove that. So that's when I set out. Schwaller was by then dead, and I think didn't even recognize himself the bombshell that he'd let out in that single sentence. And so I'm not a geologist, but I'm certainly capable of reading, and went to the library and did a ton of work and developed that theory with plenty of backup, actually. I consulted geologists, and so I was pretty sure of myself. And that was a long chapter at the end of Serpent in the Sky, but nobody was about to listen to me without the letters after my name. And it took another 10 years before I came across Robert Schock, then young, but very accomplished and credentialed geologist at Boston University. And another long story that I won't go into here. But eventually, skeptical at first, he came around to absolutely agree that the Sphinx had been weathered by water, and not just any old kind of water, not standing water and not necessarily flood water as such from the Nile, but rather precipitation-induced weathering. In other words, rain, lots and lots and lots of rain over long periods of time. And since the Sphinx is now in very arid desert, I mean, there's barely an inch or two of rain in Cairo a year, as it is now, as it stands now, and it wasn't much different in classical dynastic Egyptian times. In other words, it's been pretty dry there since about 5,000 B.C. So if the Sphinx is weathered by rainwater, when was the rain? And that's a question of some debate among even those of us, there are plenty of us now, the geologists who agree that it is indeed water weathering. So the question then is when the rain fell, and this is a matter of some debate. Schock takes the most conservative position possible, although even that's pretty revolutionary. So somewhere between 5 and 7,000 B.C. as the latest date that the Sphinx could possibly have been weathered into the condition that it is. I base my own ideas upon a combination of things. One is the precession of the equinoxes, that the Sphinx is probably a Leo marker. And the other, the Egyptian texts themselves, which, if you put them all together, give you roughly a date of the onset or the seed of Egyptian civilization sprouting somewhere around 36,000-38,000 years ago, which coincides with two processional ages ago, when the Sphinx would indeed have faced the constellation of Leo at the spring equinox.
Yeah, and that's
so
that's
this
an
is
amazing...
where we stand, and needless to say, in civilization, according to what I like to call the quackademics, is start somewhere around 4,000 B.C., this is heresy of the deepest order.
Yeah, by about 30,000 years.
Yeah, right, exactly, by about 30,000 years, right.
Right. And, you know, I went to that U.S. geological meeting with you and Robert, it's probably 5 years ago now.
It was exactly 5 years ago. It was 2000.
Yeah, and the evidence is just compelling. I mean, the number of slides, and we must have had 100 geologists in the room there.
No, we had 500.
Well, you know, and
big room.
And there were only just one or two objections, and even those I thought Robert put in their place very orderly. So, yes, the evidence is strong. Now, what are other, Egyptologists saying about this?
Well, I mean, the Egyptologists are fighting it tooth and nail, and since they own, this is the problem, as you probably all now know yourself from your own experiences, but I have decades of that experience, they own the playing field. And when the evidence doesn't go, or when the game doesn't go the way they like, they move the goalposts. And if it still isn't the way they like, then they change the rules. And as long as you are playing on their playing field, there's not much you can do other than to just keep playing the game one way or another. But it is possible, in certain instances, to do an end run around it. And that's actually what I'm hoping to do. I'm trying to get together a panel of geologists, three on our side, three on their side, to get over there and look into just this question of water weathering. And I'm waiting for a response, actually, from my tour operator and friend in Egypt, Mohammed Nazmi. I've sent him a formal proposal to put to Zahi Hawass to see if we can get permission to get those guys over there. And we're not going to be doing anything technical, nothing invasive, no seismographs, no radar, nothing, to look just into that water weathering question and then report back. And if that gives us the kind of publicity we need, because unfortunately, you like to think that science advances via evidence, and when the evidence is good enough, then it's accepted. But in fact, it isn't. It's political in nature, and we can take a good lesson from the way politics work. The incumbent will do anything and everything, principled or unprincipled, in order to retain power, and that's how it is in academia.
Sure.
So we're hoping we can get this over there. Zahi has actually promised me verbally that he would okay this idea, and I was supposed to meet him on this last trip, but it just didn't work out. He had to cancel an appointment because he had to go off somewhere on some ministerial duties. He's head of the whole shebang now, Zahi.
Hey, John.
He's the big honcho.
We have to take a quick break, but sure. we'll be right back on the Cosmic Influence with our guest, John Anthony West.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Cruttenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden. I'm here with my co-host Jeff Patino, and we are talking to rebel Egyptologist John Anthony West. John, you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we've been talking about the Sphinx and how old it might be, and I think you threw out a figure something like 30,000 plus years, 38,000 years. And I guess that you said based on precession, that would probably be based on the vernal equinox when
yes.
the Sphinx lined up with Leo. Another way to look at it would be the autumnal equinox, and we're finding a lot of evidence that the ancients did indeed use the autumnal equinox, at least the Vedic Indians did. And so then it might possibly be 24,000 years, but either way, it's significantly more than the current paradigm that we're now seeing.
Totally, actually, Walter, but even more important, I mean, the Sphinx is, I think, unquestionably the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, no matter how ruinous it may now be. And, I mean, a great work of sculpture you can do with hammers and chisels, but adjacent and in front of the Sphinx are temples that are built of the rock that was quarried out in order to free its core body from the enclosure. The Sphinx sort of sits like in a great stone bathtub, with a big space all around it. Mm-hmm. And those blocks were quarried out in room-sized chunks, weighing somewhere between 50, 75, 200, up to 200 tons. And they're put into place in these temples as if in a jigsaw puzzle. We don't have a technology that could do that today. I mean, this is formal. We went to people who have used the biggest cranes in the world. They looked at these temples and said, well, yeah, we could lift those stones just, and it would take us 6 weeks to move each stone, but we wouldn't know how to rig it to get them into place like that, slotted in so finely. So, yeah, we can fly to the moon, so we could probably figure it out if it were important enough to us. But the fact is that we can't, and they could, and if we're talking now about a date anywhere before dynastic Egypt, according to the standard paradigm, I mean, people had just climbed down out of the trees. Everybody was hunter-gatherers. And to suddenly are confronted by a technology that we can't reproduce today with all of our high-tech stuff, then it's not just the dating of history that needs a rethinking, but a total reinterpretation of what it is that they knew. So this is, needless to say, this is a bombshell, and of course the flak, there's a saying in the Air Force, an Air Force buddy of mine told me this, that the flak is always thickest when you're right over the target.
And I know within Egyptian mythology, the dynastic Egyptians don't actually have any records of having built the Sphinx, they only have records of having restored it.
Not even restored, it's only first mentioned in the text, in fact, in the Thutmose stele between the paws of the Sphinx at around 1450 BC. And until that point, there's simply no mention of the Sphinx at all, anywhere.
And I know you've connected it with the constellation Leo as well. And one of the things I've always found interesting, you could probably shed some light on this, if you look at other representations of Sphinxes in Egyptian statues, and then you look at the Great Sphinx, the head on the Great Sphinx seems disproportionately small compared to other statues of Sphinxes that have been found. And I wonder, do you suppose that the Sphinx could originally have been a lion and that the head was reshaped at some point to turn it into a Sphinx, which might have even connected it further with the constellation Leo?
Well, that's a good question, but unfortunately, it's probably forever unanswerable. Because it is too small, we're pretty well convinced that it has to have been recarved sometime in the past. How far back, we just don't know. But, yes, it could have been a lion, or it could have been a face similar to the face that's on there. See, there are anomalies about that face, because many travelers in the 19th century noted that that looks like an African face, not an Egyptian African face, but a sub-Saharan African face. So that's another bombshell, but that's probably unanswerable. The fact that it is, I mean, the Egyptians knew, understood about proportion, and you have 1,000 sphinxes that are all where the head is in perfect proportion to the body for that particular object, and here there's the Sphinx, the most spectacular of all, and it's demonstrably too small. But unfortunately, it's not a question you can really devote much scholarly time to, because you can't, I mean, how can we know unless we develop some kind of miraculous Curlian technology that is able to photograph what the Sphinx used to be? We're stuck with it.
Sure. The film that you produced, Mystery of the Sphinx, that has now aired, I guess, all over the world, and I'm sure you get a lot of feedback on that.
What sorts of comments or questions are you getting from your fans around the world?
Oh, well, I mean, that keeps going. It's simmered down now, although it still gets shown. Well, I mean, most people who look at it from 10 years old and up think that it's absolutely compelling evidence. And so it is, as far as we and most of the rest of the geological community are concerned. The Egyptologists shout and scream and put forward objections that range from just wrong to idiotic. But that's what we have to contend with, and that's what our geo panel, if we get them over there, we hope this summer, will address. But, yeah, I mean, it's made a considerable impact, even though it is, you know, regarded by the quackademics as pseudo-archaeology. It's shown in lots of schools, lots of teachers who are perfectly capable of assessing evidence on their own without even having to be geologists, show it to their students, and so it ticks along. But we really need that big media break because, as I said, it's not the quality of the evidence that changes the paradigm, but rather it's a matter of, in this case, of publicity. Actually, Machiavelli has a very good quote that I use in The Serpent in the Sky, that is, the reformer who works only through persuasion gets nowhere, but only when the reformer can compel attention does the paradigm change. But basically that's it. So it really is more a question of PR and publicity and changing not just public opinion but academic opinion, and it doesn't even matter if it's, I mean, I don't expect the Egyptologists to cave in until they absolutely have their heads are pushed under the water, or the archaeologists, but the rest of the scientific community, and there we have plenty of support. It doesn't matter
Hopefully we can help you with that support here, but we've got to take a quick break first.
Okay.
You're listening to Cosmic Influence with Walter Cruttenden, Jeff Pitino, and our special guest star, John Anthony West. We'll be right back.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
What does HealthyLife.net and Amazon.com have in common? Well, they're both available on the internet. They both give great value. But most important, most of our positive program hosts and guests are accomplished authors, and their books are available from, you got it, Amazon.com. Now it even gets better than that, because when you're listening on air to a HealthyLife.net host or guest, you can go directly to Amazon.com and you can order your book while you're still listening to your favorite HealthyLife.net program. So when you hear an author you like, go to the homepage of HealthyLife.net and click on Amazon.com.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Cruttenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
ByRegion.net is the largest healing arts directory on the web. Our visitors are looking for holistic practitioners, schools, events, healing services, and products. Are you in healing arts? Become a member of ByRegion.net and get the best advertising values. You can increase your client base and your traffic. If you have a website, we can bring you more traffic. Want a website? Get a beautiful web display for only $4 a month. Become a member now. Mention HealthyLife.net and get 6 months free. Visit www.byregion.net or call 828-232-0016.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden with co-host Jeff Pitino, and we have special guest star John Anthony West with us here today, and we are talking about ancient Egypt and the general paradigm of history that history we've been taught really only goes back to about 4,000, 5,000 BC, and prior to that time we are simple hunter-gatherers. But as John has been telling us, the Sphinx appears to be built long, long, long before this time, and out of extremely heavy stones, and thus it appears that not only does civilization go back farther, but we have the capability of some rather amazing technology back many more years than we've been taught. So, John, beyond the Sphinx, what sort of other things are we hearing or seeing about ancient Egypt that gives us some indication that they might have been more advanced than we've been taught?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, to begin with, the measures and the way that the temples are sited and oriented means that they had they knew the dimensions of the earth, and the measuring systems are earth commensurate. In other words, you couldn't have those measures if you didn't understand the diameter and the circumference of the earth. The way that they're sited means that they have an advanced astronomy. The knowledge of precession, of course, a big bone of contention with the quack academics, but they didn't have it. There's tons of evidence now that they did, even among in the Egyptological journals themselves, as the occasional somebody who pops up. It's quite clear that they had this. The work, I think, and you know him pretty well yourself, Laird Scranton, I think this is like Champollion 2.0, his book Hidden Meanings and the soon-to-appear Deeper Meanings, where he demonstrates that the ancient Egyptians and the Dogon, a little tribe in the west of Africa, have a cosmology that is virtually identical with, anyway, consistent with the latest cosmology being developed in astrophysics, torsion theory and string theory and quantum mechanics and all of these kinds of things. Now, this is, to my mind, this is hugely important because even Schwaller indicates this sort of thing, but when he's writing back in the 50s, our science wasn't good enough to draw those kinds of conclusions. If it becomes clear that, A, they have a technology in their hands that we can't reproduce, and they also have a science that's as good as our science, except it isn't expressed in mathematical formula that only mathematicians can understand, but rather in myths and legends and symbols that anybody can understand, then suddenly the whole notion of advanced civilization in the very, very distant past, it keeps on acquiring, got as many teeth now as a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And so it's no longer, I mean, it's no longer, it wasn't to begin with airy-fairy or New Agey, but it's now getting backed up by increasingly exact and detailed evidence.
I hear you. On the sighting, for example, you know, we see so many structures throughout the ancient world that are aligned with the cardinal points, and particularly the equinox, but also the solstices. And it's not just casually aligned. I think I'd read that the Great Pyramid of Giza is lined within just a few arc minutes of the Earth's actual spin axis.
Right.
And, you know, modern buildings today, even if they wanted to, they'd have a very difficult time doing that. And so any idea on why this tremendous care and precision is taken in these ancient structures?
And especially in light of we know that the Egyptians would tear down and rebuild temples over hundreds of years just to keep them in alignment with stars. So obviously they knew they were moving.
And yes, well, the why leads, as you know, Walter, directly to your own particular interest, actually, because the why has to be astrological. It isn't just to be able to know when to plant corn or wheat, which is the usual explanation for this. I mean, these unbelievably correct synchronized calendars are there for a reason, and it's because they knew what we don't know anymore, which is that the motions of the heavens correspond to the seasons on Earth. And it's very important. All of these civilizations orchestrated their entire civilization, their ceremonies, their rituals, and so on, to synchronize with these particular motions of the heavens. I mean, otherwise, who cares when the equinox is or the solstice? Particularly, why should you, you know, put up a building the size of a city oriented to a couple of arc minutes to the North Pole or whatever it is, but or the cardinal points? They're simply major technological work is always done for a reason. In our case, I mean, you know, we might build atom bombs or weapons of mass destruction to very fine tolerances. We have our own reasons for doing so, but precision is always, at least in our world, it corresponds to the function. We don't build a wheelbarrow with Ferrari tolerances, and it wouldn't even be a good wheelbarrow if it were that fine. And we need those tolerances when we're building a Ferrari. So the Egyptians did all of this work, and so did the other civilizations, but Egypt is interesting because there's so much of it left. So they had a reason for doing this, and I think this all has to do, it all comes back to the only living tradition of these great cycles of civilization, which is, of course, the Hindu, with their yugas. And then it's a question, and this is where it gets really important, where are we in that yuga cycle? You and I know, differ a bit on that. You think we're, to a certain extent, out of the Kali Yuga and out of the darkness by more years than I think we're out of it.
Yeah, in terms of the great cycle of precession, we do think that you know, you can see evidence of high cultures all around the planet going back 3,000-4,000 years, and they're all declining. All the Mediterranean civilizations decline as you move towards the Dark Age. The Indian civilization, the Americas, and obviously Mesopotamia and Egypt, and yet then we have this finally Greece and Rome fall, and you have the Great Dark Ages, which seem to go on about 1,000 years, and then there's a renaissance, a rebirth of higher culture. And so, yes, I do think that the low point coincides with the depths of the Dark Ages there, but I guess it's time to take another break.
One more break. So you're listening to The Cosmic Influence. If at any time you'd like more information on the topics we're discussing here, please visit our website, loststarbook.com.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Cruttenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
In college, I took a lot of history and liberal arts classes, and frankly, I don't remember much of any of it. But as an adult, I find myself engrossed in fascinating programs on the A&E and History Channel. They've pretty much helped me to be pretty impressive at social functions, and I just found out today that I can purchase DVDs of my favorite A&E and History Channel programs right through HealthyLife.net. You should visit HealthyLife.net and order your favorite A&E and History Channel program DVDs as well, and then discover how many people you can impress during your next social occasion.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you doing?
And we are talking with our special guest today, Rebel Egyptologist John Anthony West. And John, we were just talking about the this cycle where these great ancient civilizations around the world seem to all decline into a dark age. But I'm curious, just within Egypt, what are some of the areas that display the highest ancient culture and give us some dates and, you know, your opinion of this?
Sure. Well, you see, Egypt is unique in that it's the only ancient culture where you can actually go and visit it and see 3,000 years worth of civilization. So when you get there, okay, for the moment, forgetting that the Sphinx is much, much older, and the pyramids themselves, that's another can of worms, but the present pyramids probably are built, or what we see was probably built in Old Kingdom times, but they are, this is demonstrable, they're either superimposed upon or replaced structures that were earlier, that were built earlier, probably coeval with the Sphinx. And when you look at the sculpture and the statuary of Old Kingdom Egypt, there's simply nothing like it later on in Egypt. And, I mean, it took 3,000 years to go from its height down to the chaos of Greco-Roman, bastardized, degenerate Egypt. But you can watch it happening in front of your eyes. I mean, you go to the, particularly to Giza and Saqqara, and you see Old Kingdom Egypt in its glory. When you look at a reconstruction of the complex at Saqqara, supposedly built, oh, almost certainly built, around 2700 B.C., it looks like something designed by Frank Lloyd Wright on a genius day. I mean, it's absolutely spectacular. Very hard to imagine this just coming out of the Stone Age. When you get to New Kingdom Egypt, Middle Kingdom, there's not that much left. It's still absolutely magnificent stuff, but it doesn't have the same power and it doesn't have the same purity. And usually it doesn't have the same kind of precision, but sometimes it does. They could still do this. And in fact, there's work by very interesting people. Chris Dunn wrote a book called The Giza Power Plant. He's a machinist who designs the machines that make things to a hundred thousandth of a degree of tolerance for space shuttles and that sort of stuff. He contends that you can't get those kinds of tolerances in stone unless you have some sort of technology, but no one's ever found the technology. In any event, when you go from the New Kingdom and you get down to Ptolemaic Egypt under the Ptolemies, who were the successors to Alexander the Great, you see the whole thing becoming heavy and ornate and much less, both much less massive and much less refined, and then Ptolemies, the Romans take over and the whole thing degenerates into chaos, into the, you see what happens in front of your nose, you see what happens when a civilization based upon spiritual development gives way to one that's based upon material concerns, and it's a real gut thumper. I mean, it's a very moving experience to watch this happening in front of your eyes. So there it is. I mean, there's just simply no question about when you go back into the Yuga cycle and the great year and the whole idea of civilization going cyclically, there's the evidence. It's in front of your nose, and to deny that that's the case is simply irresponsible, to put the nicest possible spin on it. And then when you add that to the new work, the understanding that they had an advanced astronomy and an astrophysics to go with it, you're then confronted with the real reality of civilization as a cycle, and then it's a question of where are we within that cycle. And as we said earlier, we disagree a little bit on that, not much, but the couple of hundred years makes a difference. I agree that because of the terrific creativity of modern science, that creativity wasn't there in quite the same way 1,000 years ago. But from a philosophical and spiritual point of view, we're in the darkest age of all. I mean, the Christianity that's responsible for the Gothic cathedrals is a far cry from the religiosity of the Church of Progress and the even more degenerate religiosity of the Jerry Falwells and Pat Robertsons of the world.
John, knowing what we know and all the newer ideas and evidence that's coming out as far as Egypt and the idea that it is older. And the evidence that it is older, what steps can we take to bring these ideas into the mainstream? And because I know it still faces a lot of resistance. And what do you think is it going to take to change that paradigm as we move forward?
Well, basically, what we're doing, what the only thing that we can do, which is trying to make it as public as possible. But the evidence is one thing, and the power to get it out there in front of the mainstream, who are, in a certain sense, I mean, you know, they're sitting around watching American Idol, but actually people are not as stupid as our academics like to think they are, and when it's presented to them in the right way, our mystery of the Sphinx really, in its own way, almost started a whole cottage industry of inquiry into these ancient civilizations. So really it's a matter of media rather than of evidence. The evidence is all there, and of course it continues to accrue as very intelligent and knowledgeable and erudite people keep adding to the mix. But the real thing, I mean, here we are on the radio. Well, less people are going to listen to this than listen to Rush Limbaugh. If we had a Rush Limbaugh-sized audience, stuff might start happening.
Well, hopefully that will happen over time as... You know, it, and you're not a lone voice out there anymore.
Nope.
You know, Graham Hancock and Claude Swanson, John Burke, we talked about his work the other day. John Major Jenkins, who we had on our last show, doing the same thing in the Mayan culture. And, you know, the ball is rolling, I think, in large part thanks to that film that you got out there, Mystery of the Sphinx. And hopefully it'll keep rolling. And that's the purpose of not only these shows, but our conference, which let me give a quick plug on that.
Sure.
Each year we have this conference on procession and ancient knowledge. Last year we held it at Sedona, and this year it'll be at the University of California, Irvine. And we will have quite a lineup of speakers.
Yeah, we've got a fantastic lineup. Well, John, you will be there. We've got...
Yeah, I will be.
Graham Hancock, physicist John Daring, Walter mentioned Claude Swanson, astronomer Jeff Marcy will be there as well.
Yeah, we just got Jeff Marcy. He is the number one solar planet hunter in the world, and so we're very, very pleased to have him. So we're almost out of time here, but we want to thank you, John, for being on the program, and once again, maybe we can give your website here so people know where to reach you.
Your website is www.jawest.com?
No, .net.
.net, I'm sorry.
.net, very important.
www.jawest.net, and your email address is jawsphinx@aol.com, if people want to get in contact with you. And you are listening to The Cosmic Influence with Walter Crutenden and Jeff Pitino.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Crutenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Crittenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
What does HealthyLife.net and Amazon.com have in common? Well, they're both available on the internet. They both give great value. But most important, most of our positive program hosts and guests are accomplished authors, and their books are available from, you got it, Amazon.com. Now, it even gets better than that, because when you're listening on air to a HealthyLife.net host or guest, you can go directly to Amazon.com and you can order your book while you're still listening to your favorite HealthyLife.net program. So when you hear an author you like, go to the homepage of HealthyLife.net and click on Amazon.com.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Crittenden with co-host Jeff Pitino, and you've been listening to us and our special guest this week, John Anthony West. Our guest before that was John Major Jenkins, and not sure who we're going to have on our next program, but
I think it's actually Graham Hancock.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
So we'll be back with him. Again, if you have any interest in the topics we've discussed, visit our website at loststarbook.com.
Or if you hardcore research people out there really want to understand the binary theory behind the rise and fall of civilization, go to binaryresearchinstitute.org. And remember, we're in an ascending age, and things are getting better.